Every episode of this podcast is about true things that have happened at some point or another on this planet. Each episode is different than the next, and they are each centered around stories that are odd, outlandish, or of the occult. This podcast will include foul language. This podcast may also include themes of graphic content such as murder, rape, or gore. Listener's discretion is advised.
Hello.
You sexy bastards.
Welcome
to another episode of Seven Circles. Today, we'll be talking about an oldie-timey murder guy.
Yeah. This is the story of the Torso Killer.
The Cleveland Torso Killer. The OG Torso Killer. There have been other serial killers since, given the same terribly imaginative name.
Jack the Ripper was history's first recorded serial killer and a sexual sadist. The Torso Killer was America's first recorded serial killer and a sexual sadist.
I'm one of those!
So strap on in, this is gonna be a long one, guys. Grab yourself a snack and a glass of whatever beverage you prefer, and we're gonna get into it.
We're gonna strap on into what?
Murders!
Oh. We're not gonna get the strap on?
So those two murderers reigned for 50 years and 3,500 miles away from each other, and neither of them ever got caught. Their identities were never discovered.
Were they the same dude?
No.
Oh.
Maybe.
Spoilers.
The story of the Torso Killer begins during the Great Depression in Cleveland, Ohio. During this time in Cleveland, more than 70,000 citizens were on work relief, and more than a quarter of the population was receiving government aid. The homeless population was beyond count, and you could see it every night when the factories in the Flats shut down. The Flats was a giant industrial neighborhood jam-packed with warehouses and factories that produced tools and chemicals and paint and all sorts of things. The workers would come into the Flats at sunrise and leave at sunset after they shut down all of their machines. During the night, the area would be flooded with the homeless. It was their city. A lot of these homeless folk were drifters who used the railways to travel. In between the Flats and one of the main railroads that sliced through Cleveland lay a gully called Kingsbury Run. Kingsbury Run was said to be haunted, and it was one of the few places where the homeless did not set up their camps. And the rumors of the run being haunted ramped up during the Torso Killer's reign in Cleveland.
On September 23rd, 1935, a pair of boys were playing near Kingsbury Run. They were racing each other down the gully. Teenage boys are less scared of haunted places, or at least they pretend to be. The older boy made it to the bottom first and turned to yell victoriously at his friend. But he spotted something in the high grass and went over to investigate instead. His friend made it down to the bottom and froze next to him. The boys looked at each other and simultaneously fucked right off to find the nearest policeman. Sergeant Arthur Marsh and Patrolman Arthur Stitt arrived at the scene. They found a headless man, naked except for his socks. Oh, and his penis was also missing. So that's not where he was wearing one of his socks, I guess. So the officers began to search the area for the missing parts. They did not find them. Instead, they found another corpse. Detectives Orly May and Emil Musil arrived at the scene at this point.
Wow, those are some names that you cannot make up.
Or pronounce. Orly May immediately deduced that the bodies had been murdered elsewhere and dumped into the Kingsbury Run gully. The remains had both been neatly laid out with their arms tucked to their sides. There was no blood splatter anywhere. It seemed that the murderer had washed the bodies before placing them in the gully.
Both corpses had been decapitated and their schlongs removed.
Schlongectomy!
About 20 feet away from the bodies, the members were eventually found just laying at the top of the embankment. 75 feet away from the bodies, their heads were found in two separate shallow graves. As the police searched the area more, they began to find articles of bloodstained clothing that belonged to the victims. When the autopsies were performed on the two bodies, something stood out.
Just not their dicks.
One corpse was that of an older man who might have been in his 50s, and he had been dead for about 2 weeks. There was the presence of an unknown preservation chemical on his skin. Even so, the body was badly deteriorated. Deteriorated.
There it is. If it was an unknown chemical and the body was decomposing, how did they conclude that it was a preservation agent?
Through science.
Oldie-timey science.
Yeah, they had some beakers and some bottles in a lab, and they put some, like, water in one and some solvent in another one, and like had some skin in another one. Yeah.
Did they have petri dishes?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
The other corpse was that of a man said to be in his 20s, and he had only been dead for 2 or 3 days. The cause of death for both of these men was deemed to be decapitation.
That'll do it.
The police were not able to lift any fingerprints off of the bodies, but one of the corpses was identified. The younger man was Edward A. Andrassy. Andrassy was an unemployed man who liked to party and get into trouble. Because of his lifestyle choices, the police thought that his murder had something to do with the local gangs. And there were a lot of local gangs in Cleveland at this time. So the cops and detectives got together and decided to call in an outside source, legendary gangbuster Elliot Ness. And soon after, the district forgot about the two corpses and focused on gang control. The other corpse, his identity was never determined. They were victims numbers 2 and 3.
A year before these two men were found, a carpenter was walking along the beach of Lake Erie. It was September 5th, 1934. The old man was combing the beach, trying to find any treasures that might have washed ashore from the lake. He moved a big piece of driftwood, and there she was. Victim number one. Or rather, part of her. It was a torso. The legs had been severed at the knees. The top half severed just below the belly button. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but above the knees and below the belly button does not constitute a torso. That's just a vagina. That's just a murderer's plaything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's not a torso, man. That's just a yeah, an oldie timey cunt, man.
The first fleshlight.
I guess she didn't have her socks on either. So she had been dead for about 6 months, and in the water for about half of that time. The rest of her had actually been found a few weeks prior to this by someone else. This part of her was just the upper half of her torso, or just, you know, her torso, minus the head and arms. It had been found by a man called Joseph Hedjuk. Hedjuk. Joseph Hedjuk. Wow, I'm autuming the fuck out of this script today. And get this. When he found the remains, he called a deputy about it, but the deputy just assumed that Joseph was describing leftover animal parts and told him to bury it somewhere. Why is this sounding like the episode that we did about lost things? Oh, that was up. That was near here as well. That was in this fucking the Big Lake area, right?
Mm-hmm.
The is it the Lake Superior Triangle or some shit?
Yeah.
I don't remember. Go listen to the episode if you care. But there, people just kept like burying. They buried a whole fucking pile of dead bodies because they were like, "Oh, we don't know what to do with them."
Yeah.
So yeah, don't that was fucking Michigan as well. Is this Michigan? That was Michigan too. Don't go to Michigan.
This is Cleveland.
Oh, this is fucking Cleveland. Okay. Yeah, just don't go to the Great Lakes. It's sketchy up there. You will be murdered, and someone will definitely just cut you up, rape your holes, and then bury you. Anyway, so eventually, because they're super smart, the cops realised the error of their ways and got their hands on her part. Giggity. And noted that they felt like a sexy human puzzle. Oh.
Okay.
And noted... And noted that they fit like a sexy human puzzle. And then the coroner noticed all of the cuts had been done almost surgically. So maybe it was the Ripper. Who knows? They were so precise. They ended up finding a few more of her parts, but never her head. And she was not identified. They just ended up calling her the Lady of the Lake.
Victims 1, 2, and 3 were not connected until much later.
Connected! Like, reconnected. Pause for laughter. There it is. Okay, carry on.
So the reason behind the corpses all being forgot about temporarily was because of Elliot Ness coming to work in Cleveland. This dude was a big-time gangbuster, and he was kind of a big deal. A few years before coming to Cleveland, this guy created a team of agents known as the Untouchables, and together they took down many gangs and gang leaders, including Al Capone.
Ooh, the Untouchables. The Untouchables. The Sean Connery was in that movie.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. He was transferred to Cleveland and worked for their safety department for like 6 years. And he was actually the director of the safety department and immediately began to fire cops who were caught drinking on the job and doing other nefarious things.
Drinking. So nefarious. Nefarious.
Ness took the work seriously and he would not abide by any other cop who didn't.
On January 26, 1936, at about 11 p.m, a woman went outside to investigate the howling of a dog. She found the dog in an alley behind a harvesting plant down the street from her home. The dog had been howling for hours, and most everyone assumed it was because he had been left outside in the freezing cold, just like our fucking neighbours. The woman went to see if there was anything she could do for the dog, bringing an old shawl of hers with her so the dog would have some sort of blanket. When she got closer, she could see that the dog was agitated and trying to get at something that was sitting across the alley. The dog had nearly chewed through the leash that it was tied up with to get to it.
The woman went to see what the thing was. It was a bushel basket.
What's a bushel basket?
I don't know. It's a basket that you use for your bushels. Guess.
I mean, it makes sense.
She peered inside the bushel basket. Her heart went cold. She walked very fast to the end of the alley where she met a man called Charles Page, the neighborhood butcher. She directed him to the basket to show him what she found. She told him that there were some hams in the basket, and then she just fucked off. Like, she knew what it was, and she was just like, there's some hams, bye. Charles went down to where the basket sat, and he was very confused. Why would anyone leave perfectly good hams just sitting in the alley? But when he approached the basket and pulled back the swatch of burlap that was covering it, he found no ham at all. What he saw was a human arm.
Hey, ham, arm, it's all delicious juicy meat to a dog.
True.
Ooh, piece of ham.
Charles contacted the police immediately. When they arrived, they discovered the arm and also the lower half of a female torso and her thighs. She was identified as 41-year-old Florence Polio, a sex worker.
Hacker.
Who only lived a few blocks away from where her remains were found. The police questioned many people in regards to the case, but nobody seemed to know anything. Everyone knew who she was, though.
Yeah.
And they all just assumed that she was murdered by a John.
Or a trick. A punter.
A few weeks later, a mechanic was cutting through the backyard of an abandoned house when he found the rest of Florence. Her other arm, her legs, and her upper torso were just scattered about, not even buried. The police deduced that these parts had been abandoned at the same time as the others. They never found poor Flo's head, though.
So, I mean, yeah, sure, you're finding torsos, but mainly you're finding, like, you know, vaginas or dickless lower parts, which makes you wonder what he was doing with them, right? To some extent. But in any case, the thing that they never found, so far anyway, was the head. So why wasn't he called the head killer?
Or the headless huntsman.
There you go. But yeah, so do you think that he was like cutting off the dick to make a vagina?
Maybe.
God.
We'll never know.
We'll never know.
Just leave it to your imagination, guys.
Well, if you listened to our last episode, you'd kind of get a good picture of what was going on here. And things were getting stuck into pee holes. Just, you know, a little bit lower down the shaft.
Okay. Despite the incredible likeness to the first three cases, the head of homicide, James T. Hogan, would dismiss this case and file it as a completely separate murder.
On June 5th, 1936, a few boys had set out to go fishing. They decided on a shortcut through Kingsbury Run, the aforementioned gully, which was a dried-up riverbed. The boys stopped when they spotted a pair of pants wadded up in a ball underneath a bush. One of the boys suggested they might find money in the pockets, so they went over to investigate. They grabbed a stick to pull the pants out from under the bush, and as they slid out, the pants unrolled to reveal a severed head. The boys screamed and ran all the way back home to their mother.
Wee, wee, wee.
Police arrived. Along with the head and pants, they found a complete outfit, presumably belonging to the head. Do you wear complete outfits on your head, Autumn? Do you wear your pants on your head sometimes?
Sometimes.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. They scoured the area, and about a mile west was where they found the rest of him. Underneath a bridge, almost directly in front of the railway police station, they found his completely nude body, minus the head, of course. And the head clothes. So did this guy just always walk around nude and just wear all of his clothes on his head?
Yes.
Huh. Maybe that's why he got killed. Head clothes.
Head clothes.
The coroner said that like the previous four bodies they found in such a state, his cause of death was also decapitation. The fifth body's fingerprints failed to yield an identification. But the dude was missing some teeth and he had six distinct tattoos, so the police had hope of figuring out who the man was. The cops initially tried to keep the case quiet, but eventually thought that if they put the dude's head and body on display at the morgue, then someone who knew him might step up with an ID. Over 2,000 people showed up to have a look that first day he was on display, and several thousand more during the following days. But not a single soul could name the dead man.
Well, that's probably because he always wore his clothes on his head, so you couldn't see his face.
Sergeant Hogan of the Homicide Division was still in denial that they had a repeat killer on the loose, despite four corpses being murdered the exact same way. The great Elliot Ness was still balls deep involved with raids and trying to weed out the degenerates of the department at this time, so he was no help either. Also, he continued to make the front page of all the newspapers, so this was the story everyone was talking about. The killings barely being mentioned in small articles on page 12.
So, do you reckon Ness was the torso killer?
You know, as I was reading this book, yes, I read a whole book for this episode, I had the thought rumbling around in the back of my head about Elliot being the possible dude, but if you recall, he wasn't even called into Cleveland until after the first couple bodies were found. He was off in, like, Texas or somewhere else.
New York. Sorry. Texas. Because Al Capone just hangs out in Texas a lot, I'm sure.
On July 22nd, 1936, a teenage girl was hiking through some woods out by Big Creek in Cleveland. She stomped through a gully and nearly tripped over the pale, headless corpse of a man. She screamed so loudly that dozens of nearby citizens, including some cops, came running. So I guess she wasn't too far into her hike, huh? Or the gully was just right the fuck there. Anywho, his head was found about 10 feet away from the corpse, along with his clothes, all piled up neatly next to the head.
Head clothes!
The coroner suggested that the man had been dead for about 2 months, and that, unlike the previous kills, he was murdered right there in the gully.
Murder gully!
Yes, this is the story of the murder gully.
Okay. The previous victims had been killed in a separate location from where their bodies were discovered. The coroner said that it was more than likely the same killer, though, because the man was killed via decapitation, and probably with the same knife that was used in the other slayings. This man could not be identified either. He was too badly decomposed to be fingerprinted. The police deduced that he was probably a homeless man based on his clothing alone.
I mean, if my clothes sat out next to my decomposing head for 2 months, they'd look like the clothes of a homeless man too.
I mean, yeah and no. Do you want to get into semantics here about homeless people's clothes and what they would look like and versus like a regular dude's clothes and what they would look like?
Well, maybe back then, I suppose the more affluent would have had nicer clothes rather than just like wearing a burlap sack.
Yeah.
But these days, you know.
You never know.
You go to Goodwill and you fucking walk out with a suitcase full of clothes for $10 and it's just shit that I brought down there like 3 years ago. It's fine.
The exploits of Elliot Ness continued to make the front page of all the newspapers. The noise he made drowned out all the stories of these victims. So it's noon on Thursday, September 10th, 1936. A homeless man is leaning against a girder under a bridge.
He's probably wearing my fucking clothes from Goodwill, too.
He had drifted into town via train several days earlier and hoped to leave the same way. He was near Kingsbury Run, eyeballing the passing cargo trains to see which one he wanted to hop onto. He chose one that was slowly moving into town. He looked around to make sure no railroad police were near, and seeing none, he ran for the train. On his way there, he tripped over something on the ground and went flying. After his crash landing, he cursed and got up to go over to kick whatever it was that had dared to be in his way. As he got closer to the pale white thing in the grass, he suddenly realized that this thing was the upper half of a human body with no head or arms. Forgetting the train, he ran to find a policeman. Within minutes, the law had swarmed the area. They found the torso's lower half nearby.
Did it have a penis?
Hold on. A search was conducted for the arms and head. Over the next few hours, the scene at Kingsbury Run had become a circus. Hundreds of onlookers had crowded around the edges of the gully. Reporters had flooded in, not staying at the edges of the gully, but actually going down into it where the policemen were at work.
Sounds like your mum. At the morgue, Coroner Gerber was examining the remains. He determined that this victim was a white male, because he was smart. Around 22 years old, with brown hair. 22. With brown.
Why is that confusing?
I know, it just seems very precise to be around 22.
He's a fucking coroner.
22 years old, with brown hair and a muscular build. He had been dead for about 48 hours. The head had been removed with a sharp, precise cut. The torso had been bisected just as skillfully. His genitals were also missing. This sixth corpse had driven home the fact that the city had a maniac killer on their hands. There was no longer any doubt from any party. Newspapers began to refer to this killer as the Phantom of Kingsbury Run, the Horrible Headhunter, there you go, head, and the Torso Murderer. I think they missed a trick not calling him the Cleveland Cleaver, don't you?
25 detectives were now assigned to the case full-time. They followed many leads that led nowhere. Well, some of the leads led to other murderers, but never the torso killer. They arrested a vagrant who was under suspicion for murdering another homeless man. They assumed that this man was also the torso killer because the weapon he used was a long surgical knife. But this vagrant was quickly deemed not to be the killer because of his MO. He brutally stabbed the homeless man to death and just left the body where it was. He also rambled a lot and did not have the cognitive abilities that the torso killer would require to do the deeds that he had done. This man did go to prison for murder, though, so that's nice.
Is it, though? We don't know what the other hobo did. He might have deserved a good stabbing.
I guess. Finally, though, the torso killer had begun to dominate headlines. This made the citizens of Cleveland pretty uneasy and in some cases just straight up paranoid. Hundreds of leads came pouring into the police from citizens, but most of them were bogus. Nighttime in the Kingsbury Run area was pretty crazy. Railroad employees began working in pairs and arming themselves. A lot of the homeless population just got up and fucked off to a different part of town, or even to different cities in most cases. The railroad police began hiring more staff and they were working overtime to patrol the area more vigilantly. The head, arms, and peepee of Victim 6 were never found and he was never ID'd. And Elliot Ness finally started to pay attention to the case. After the sixth body was found, as we have just discussed, security and police were on high alert. But after a few weeks with no fresh corpse and no solid leads, security and police started to relax. And Elliot Ness was not having that. Whenever he saw a department or an individual begin to become complacent about the torso killer, he would deliver a swift kick to their ass and get them remotivated. Even if they failed to catch the killer, Elliot said, he wanted to try with all his power to keep the killer from accessing another victim. Elliot even set up an undercover operation, dressing policemen in homeless gear and sending them out to Kingsbury Run to camp out. But news of this got leaked to the press immediately, and the whole thing was ruined before it even started.
Homeless gear.
A meeting was held among all the policemen, detectives, the city council, and other such city leaders, and humans with much importance. The city's lead coroner took control of the meeting and began to speak of his medical findings and the conclusion that he himself drew up of this killer. Yes, the coroner created a profile of this murderer. And these were his findings. Number 1.
All 6 torso killings were the work of one individual working alone.
Number 2.
The killer is psychotic but not recognizably insane.
Number 3.
The killer displays definite knowledge of the human anatomy and some surgical skills, but might not have actual medical training.
Number 4.
The killer is large and strong.
They're strong like bear.
Number 5.
The killer probably lives close to Kingsbury Run.
6.
The killer probably has a private workshop or laboratory where he does the deed.
And finally, number 7.
The killer only preys upon the lower class.
It's weird how they narrowed this shit down so specifically, but yet could not find the murderer. Elliot Ness was trying really hard to solve this case so that he could get back to doing what he was doing before, an internal investigation throughout the entire city of Cleveland's police departments. After a few weeks, the headlines of the newspapers slowly stopped being about the torso killer, and the story eventually stopped being reported on altogether. So Elliot appointed some other detectives to the case so he could get back to doing his own thing. And Ness was busting cops left and right. He even busted the police chief, who had been stealing from the evidence room for a long ass time.
Wouldn't you? All those drugs and hooker heads?
He ended up suspending 6 other cops and firing 2 of them. And this story made the headlines of the press and helped to further make people forget that there was a madman on the loose.
On February 23rd, 1937, a man called Robert Smith called the police. He reported having been walking along the Euclid Beach at Lake Erie when he saw something wash onto the shore. He initially thought it might be some dead animal, but I think you can guess where this is probably going. After taking a closer look, Robert realized that this was the upper torso of a woman, minus the head and arms. So he called the police, as we already established, and they showed up in droves. Fun fact, this is the same beach that the first victim, Lady of the Lake, was found on 3 years prior. The cause of death of this 7th victim could not be determined, but Coroner Gerber figured that it certainly was not decapitation with this victim. I mean, I don't know how he determined that. I would
I
like
can tell
to
know. You.
Oh, please tell us.
Okay, so if the head had been cut off after the body had already been killed, they could determine that because of like blood clotting and stuff. So the head must have been cut off after the body had been killed this time.
Oh, okay. So if the head had been cut off while the person was alive, it would have drained of blood. Whereas if it had been cut off afterwards, there would still be clotted blood in the head.
Yeah.
Okay. But they didn't have the head yet.
In the neck, too. In the neck. In the areas of the wound.
You just did a science. The woman was a petite brunette who had given birth more than once. Fucking Coroner Gerber, man.
He's a smart man.
Yeah. But wait. They only had the upper torso. That's all they had. But he determined, it wasn't decapitation, and she'd given birth more than once.
They probably had, like, the stomach area, the womb.
Okay. I mean, he usually cuts it off just beneath the belly button, right?
He does it randomly whenever he likes, okay?
Okay. So she had been in the water for 48 hours, not 47, and not 48 and a half, but 48 hours, and probably dead for 4 days. The coroner also stated
This killer is giving us a new torso roughly every 5 months.
Police searched for number 7's missing parts for a few weeks after, to no avail. About 2 months later, her bottom half washed up on shore at the lake, but no other parts were ever found, and number 7 was never identified.
And her massive gaping cervix confirmed Dr. Gerber's findings. She had indeed given birth twice.
Leads started to come in again when this new victim made the headlines. Police chased down the leads. Men were brought in and questioned. Many, many men. But not a single soul even remotely resembled the profile of this specific killer. Among the suspects, we had a voodoo doctor, a crazy Greek, and a mad Russian.
Was he not strong like bear?
No, he was mad like Hatter.
All three ended up being jailed for other crimes, but all three had solid alibis and could not be connected to the torso killings. The summer of 1937 in Cleveland was an intense one. Everyone was on edge about this killer, and the citizens were starting to get bored with Elliot Ness. At first, they loved to see the cops go down for all their crimes. But as the months wore on, people started to see that Elliot was, at this point, at the bottom of the barrel. He had succeeded in flushing out the bad cops, but he kept on going. And this was starting to piss people off because Elliot was literally busting cops for every minor infraction. The Clevelandites, Clevelanders, Clevelandylanders,
the steamers,
they were wondering just what the fuck and why is Elliot not using his smartass brain to track down this actual murderer?
Because he was the murderer.
And then there was this massive union strike, so Elliot was like, oh, here we go. I'll go police that, because that will be easy.
Was Elliot Ness from the Middle East, Autumn?
No.
just checking.
Rose Wallace vanished in August of 1936, and her skull was found during this time in the summer of 1937. She was dubbed victim number 8 because she was the 8th one found, but it's more likely that she was victim number 3 or 4. They found her skull and her torso, but her arms and legs were never found. She was able to be identified through her dental records. There was speculation about whether or not she was a victim of the torso killer, but most signs pointed to yes. The obvious ones are the patterns the knife left on the bones when she was decapitated and dismembered. She was also the only non-Caucasian victim.
Was she definitely a black lady? Or had he just chopped off the massive black schlong? So the other lady who was found washed up on the shore, I mean, she got a fancy name. She was the Lady of the Lake. They never found her arms and legs, and she kind of floated to shore. Why didn't they call this one Bob? On July 7th, 1937, at about 5:30 a.m., one of the guardsmen that was involved with the union strike was chilling on a bridge at West 3rd Street, watching a tugboat pass underneath, probably a Cleveland steamer. After the boat passed, he turned to leave, but turned back quickly because he saw something bobbing in the water out of... At first, the guardsman thought it to be part of a store mannequin, but the longer he watched it bob up and down, he began to realise that it had body hair. Mannequins don't have body hair, usually. Unless it's one of Dahmer's mannequins.
The guardsman ran and grabbed 3 of his fellow workers, and the 4 men fished the thing out of the river. It was the lower half of a man's torso. 2 of them ran to phone police. The police showed up and began to notice other parts of the man floating lazily in the Cuyahoga River.
Lazily? What did you want this dead, dismembered dude to be doing, Autumn? Breaststroke?
Butterfly stroke.
Oh, okay.
They pulled out both of the man's legs, one of which had been severed at the knee. They found a burlap bag in the reeds, and the bag was labeled chicken feed, but actually contained the upper half of the torso wrapped in newspaper.
Homeless gear.
Over the next few days, police continued to find more parts of number 9 around the area. The pieces were assembled at the morgue, and Coroner Gerber said,
"Cause of death, decapitation. again.
Number 9 was a little different than the previous 8 victims. 9 was cut up into more pieces. He had also been disemboweled. The heart was also removed, and the coroner said that the killer had
cut open the chest with one stroke and pulled the heart out with one hand.
Right. A coroner's meant to fearmonger like that.
How is he fearmongering? He's just stating facts.
So it's a fact that the dude cut open the chest with one stroke, which is highly fucking unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
Getting through the ribs and everything, and then pulled out the heart with one hand. He knew that for a fact, did
yes.
he, Autumn?
Yes, he envisioned it in his mind as he did the autopsy.
Kalima!
Fuck is that?
Indiana Jones? Temple of Doom?
Temple of Doom?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. One of the good Indiana Jones movies.
They're good all stuff. Good.
Was the Aliens one good, though, Autumn?
Fuck yeah, it had Shia LaBeouf in it.
Oh, that's exactly why it sucked.
No, that was why it was good.
So, the victim had been around 35 to 40 years old, with brown hair and clean fingernails. His fingerprints yielded nothing, though, and everyone on the case assumed that the victim, unlike most of the others, was not a vagrant.
But his sack?
His head was never found, and number 9's identity is still a mystery.
Sack guy.
The slaying made headlines.
Headlines!
And once again, citizens of Cleveland were pissed at Elliot Ness because he was supposed to be this great cop, but yet he couldn't find this killer that was on the loose. Despite public outcry, Ness continued to focus his attention on the union strike.
As 1937 drew to a close, there were no new leads in the torso case, but no new bodies were found either. Remember, it had been deduced that the killer kills every 5 months. The last body they found was in July. So by December, citizens were just waiting on the edge of their seats for news of victim number 10. Then January rolled around and still no bodies. There was not another sign of the torso killer until May 2nd, 1938, 10 months after the last body was found. Number 10 was discovered in 2 burlap sacks floating in the Cuyahoga River, again near the West 3rd Street Bridge. Inside the bags were 2 halves of a woman's torso, along with both thighs and a left foot. So, I think the every 5 month thing is kind of nonsense, don't you? Because not only are they assuming that they have found every single body, we also know that many of these bodies were not found in the order in which they were killed. So my point being that just because they didn't find one for 10 months, 2 people could have been killed in that time. They might have just not found
they didn't
one,
find
right?
It yet. But at the way the coroner decides the like time of death and stuff, the time stamps on the bodies, he's the one that deduced it was every 5 months because of the decay and stuff. You know what I'm saying?
I understand. But because they didn't find one for 10 months, it doesn't mean that there weren't more bodies out there that had been killed during that time.
True. Yeah. So Coroner Gerber deduced that this victim had been a 5'4" petite woman with a size 5 foot.
Man, this coroner's pretty great. He can use a measuring tape, and he can even put shoes on feet. Truly a master of his art.
She had been 24 years old and had given birth twice.
How the actual fuck did he know that? Maybe she was just super into black dudes.
Well,
or fisting. Or both.
I think coroners are trained medically to determine if a woman has given birth or not just by examining their body.
You mean back in the 1930s when they were still like carrying out autopsies with a fucking sword and stuff?
Yeah, they could still determine that apparently.
What tool did they use to determine the size of a lady's innards, Autumn?
I mean, they don't have to look at their vagina to determine if they've given birth or not. It's usually, hey, let's cut open the womb and see if this has been used or not.
Oh, okay, so they didn't just, like, test her out real quick?
No.
Oh, that's a shame. But, again, womb, I get that. I'm being somewhat facetious here. I'm not saying you can't tell whether or not a woman has given birth, but to say how many times seems a little bit odd to me. That's all I'm getting at here.
I don't know. Science.
Vagina science.
So the cause of her death was decapitation. He commented that with both victims 9 and 10, the killer had become more erratic with his cuts. The first 8 victims were sliced meticulously, while these 2 had more regular slices. As if he was in a hurry. Her head, arms, and legs were never found, and she was never identified.
I've wondered with a few of these last victims now that perhaps other people who had murderous tendencies but had never indulged were actually out there trying to do some copycat killings. You know, just going out there and doing it thinking, well, they'll eventually find the real torso killer, which means that I can just go and have a little fun.
Maybe.
Meanwhile, Ness had no idea what the fuck to do about the torso killings. The citizens of Cleveland were terrified and they wanted the killer to be caught and brought to justice. But Ness was in over his head. He was a good cop. If not, one of the greatest cops who ever lived.
Which, let's be honest, isn't hard, is it?
The bar is low.
Yeah. And yeah, he was at least as good at his job as Coroner Gerber was at his.
But he was not great at tracking down madmen. He was better at investigating known criminals.
Yeah, because Al Capone, not mad at all.
The unknown was too much for him. So, to try and placate the citizens, Ness began to create youth programs for wayward teens in order to
clean up the streets that had become overrun with teenage gangs.
Wow, I guess he'd been in the country a while after moving over here from the Middle East, because he suddenly has this southern twang.
And he did a good job of this.
His southern twang or the cleaning up of the streets?
The wayward teens.
3 months later, victim number 11 turns up in an abandoned lot near East 9th Street. 3 men who were out scavenging for metal to sell came upon the remains of a woman. One of the men went to phone the police while the other 2 stood there and poked the body with a stick.
With their what?
Stick.
Oh.
The 2 men begin to call over anyone who passed by, saying,
"Look what we found! It's the Mad Butcher's 11th victim!"
By the time the police arrived, there were about 100 onlookers crowded around the scene. What they found was a woman's torso wrapped in a quilt. After about an hour, police were able to scatter the onlookers and search the area for more remains and hopefully some sort of evidence. They ended up finding every single part of her body scattered on the empty lot.
Did Coroner Gerber wonder why the body appeared to have been poked with sticks hundreds of times?
Probably.
I'm sure he reached some, like, amazing conclusion. It's like, oh yes, she's been stabbed 100 times with many, many sticks. She must have given birth 17 times.
About 200 yards away from victim number 11, a garbage man was watching the police comb the lot when he noticed a strange smell. He kicked at a pile of rubbish that was nearby, and a skull tumbled out. He called over to one of the policemen, and the both of them just looked at the pile of rubbish and stared at each other in shock. Because the longer you looked at this pile of trash, the more bones you could see poking out. These bones were taken to Coroner Gerber, along with victim number 11's corpse. Gerber eventually declared that both of these bodies were victims of the torso killer.
A bag of bones, eh? Must be the penises.
Everyone was dumbfounded. 2 bodies were found in the same location, both of them fully intact. Well, dismembered and decapitated, but they were all there. The woman's body was never identified, despite the head being found, and is known simply as number 11. The skeleton had perished sometime between victims number 9 and 10, so it's possible that the killer placed 11 near the skeleton so that it would be found. Remember, there were 10 months between victims number 9 and 10, so 12 really should have been 10. The killer just hit it too well. 12 was a small man with dark hair still attached to his skull. Despite the gold teeth that still remain in the skull, 12 was also never identified.
So are we saying that the killer dumped a fresh body near an older one because no one had found the older one? Genius.
Yeah.
At this point, Ness decided to try and do something.
So soon.
He decided that raiding the shanty towns and homeless camps in Cleveland was the best route to go in order to find the torso killer. So he did. The following is an article from a local paper called The Plain Dealer.
Safety Director Elliot Ness personally supervised raid upon the packing box homes underneath the Eagle Street ramp
may contribute something towards the capture of the torso killer. We doubt it. Certainly, there was little justification in detaining all day men arrested in the raid, preventing them from collecting their tattered belongings before firemen razed the miserable huts and set fire to the debris. The men were still being held today.
The press were starting to loathe Elliot Ness, which made the citizens hate him even more.
But they thought the dude had a lab or a place he did the murders. I guess this was just an excuse to tidy up the city.
Mm-hmm. And everyone waited for another body to be found. But none ever were. And the torso killer fucked off, never to be heard from again.
Unless he was, in fact, one of the homeless folks that was rounded up.
Doubt it.
Why?
Because I think this guy was a lot more intelligent. No offense to homeless
wow.
people. No.
Yeah, you're homeless because you're fucking dumb.
No, he just had... He had more accessibility than a homeless dude would.
Accessibility?
Yeah.
What, did he have a fucking ramp for wheelchairs?
Exactly. He fucking had like a lab and a house and a place to murder and then dump the bodies. You can't just do that in a homeless shanty. You can't dismember a corpse in a homeless shanty and then move it to the gully and not be discovered.
I feel like a gully is a far easier place to murder and dismember somebody and then just fucking hock some limbs around than it is to murder a whole ass person and then drag the whole fucking bag of pieces.
But that's not what happened.
That's exactly what you just said happened.
No, like, in most cases, he was killing them in a different place and dumping them in a different location.
Exactly. So he had to fucking murder them, chop them up somewhere, and then fucking carry the whole ass yeah. fucking bag of body parts somewhere and fucking strew them around.
So you think it'd be easier to kill someone in the gully where there's like fucking children running around, fucking going fishing and shit? Like, no.
I don't know. Were they night fishing, Autumn?
I mean, listen. The manhunt continued for a few years, but to no avail.
Gonna brush over that, okay.
Elliot Ness went back to hunting down and arresting mob gangsters, because that's what he was good at. And that's it. That's the story of the Cleveland Torso Killer. And we got this from a book called Torso, written by Stephen Nichol. The book was found at a thrift store for only $2.
You're fucking welcome. So, let's touch briefly on the more recent Torso Killer, also known as the Times Square Killer, one Richard Cottingham. He raped and murdered at least 12 women, mostly hookers, and was apprehended and convicted for 5 murders between 81 and 84. That's 1981 and 1984, for the record. In 2009, he admitted to a reporter that he had committed 80 to 100 perfect murders across the US, 6 of which have since been confirmed, and he continues to this day to lead police to more. 4 survivors even came forward and testified against him. There's a documentary on Netflix, if you're that way inclined, which you probably are, since you just listened to this whole ass podcast.
Yeah, I've listened to a few podcasts about this one. I don't know. I'd have to go back and listen again. I got
that
nothing.
Interesting, huh?
Yeah, it's not that interesting.
That's why we did the other torso.
That's why we did the other one. Yeah. And even that was, I just thought the whole Elliot Ness thing was interesting because he was pretty famous and I had no idea he was connected to this case. And now we know.
He was also Kevin Costner and not Sean Connery. Just in case you were wondering.
So Kevin Costner played Elliot Ness?
Yes.
Okay. What movie?
It was The Untouchables.
The Untouchables, okay.
You've never seen it?
I saw it many moons ago. I don't remember it.
It was not that memorable to a, 11-year-old me.
So what now?
Well, I don't know. I was probably going to go throw on some anal porn and go to town. What about you?
I'll probably play some video games.
Okay, well, don't turn around. You know I don't like to be watched.
Okay.
Should we roll the credits before or after I've finished?
Probably after.
Okay, what? That's not the answer I was expecting. Well, okay. Stick around for my foreskin noises. or maybe we'll just roll the credits. Bye! Thank you for listening.
We appreciate you.
If you like us, you can come support us on Patreon at Seven Circles Pod.
We are an indie podcast, and without your support, we would not be able to do this thing that we love.
Everything was written, produced, edited, and mixed by us, Autumn and Dan.
Thanks to Caroline Gates for the artwork and Null Machine for the music.
If you have anything to say to us about this episode, come say hi to us on the social medias.
We are currently on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just search for Seven Circles Podcast. That's the number 7, not the word, plus circles like the shapes.
7 and circles. Do 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 do.
Do do do. What are you doing? Do 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 do.
Indiana Jones.
Do 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 do. Have you actually seen this movie that you apparently love so much?
I'm tone deaf, sucker.
I don't think it's that you're tone deaf, it's just that you don't remember the notes. If you remembered what they were, you'd be able to spit them out. You just your brain doesn't tell you what it should be. Yeah, okay, I might be wrong. There were just added notes and a very strange time signature there. I'm not familiar with that one. It sounded like some, like, was that like a jazz time signature there?
Ew, no. What?
Well, you love jazz.
Oh, so much.
Yeah. Fuck my life. Do you have any idea how hard it is to, like, just do this kind of shit after the credits with Autumn? It's like, it's amusing, but it's... I mean, she only sings one song at karaoke. One song. And she can't even fucking sing that, dude. I don't know why we bother.
Oh, the Bryan Adams song.
Because Kevin Costner, just in case you were wondering what the tenuous link there was.
That's not it goes.
It fucking is, Autumn.
Look into your heart.
Yeah.
You were fine. There's nothing left to hide. It's not worth fighting for. Don't tell me there's nothing I want, man.
You know it's true.
Everything I did. I do it for you.
I love how sometimes you just go fucking full James Hetfield at the end of a word when you're singing. So you put on Facebook earlier today that you think Metallica is the most overrated band.
Yes.
Tell us more about that. I mean, I agree completely.
So I feel like when James writes his songs that he just kind of, he has like a book of quotes. And he just, like, flips through a book of quotes. Like, I guess now he has the internet, but back in the day, he had just, like, books of quotes. And he would just, like, pick random quotes and just write them down and then put them all together, and that's a song. If you go and listen to any Metallica songs, you will fucking... You won't be able to unhear it.
I mean, I think we're all dying for some examples, Autumn.
Okay. Enter Sandman is a good example.
I mean, I think that's quite an inventive song.
No, bring up some lyrics here.
Oh, okay, we're doing this.
I'm just looking. Hold on. Now I lay me down to sleep. Pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I die before I wake, pray the Lord my soul to take. I mean, that's literally from something else. Hush, little baby, don't say a word, and never mind. They like took that from a nursery rhyme. This is not a good example. Maybe
I feel like that was the very premise of the song, don't you?
Well, maybe a different song. Like, you could literally look up any Metallica song, and it's you could see the inspirational quotes just rolling around in there. Look,
we could. Okay, yes. Hold on. Okay, so I just clicked on some random song that I don't know here called The Unforgiven. I mean, I love metal.
Mm-hmm.
Don't really like Metallica, so go on, tell us about it.
I'm looking. Oh, I know this song, okay.
Oh, look, there's something people say all the time. Oh, whoa!
Oh, this is just a bunch of the same shit repeating all the time. Okay,
like
maybe...
a song?
Listen. I know what I'm talking about, okay? This isn't a good example either.
Wait, there must be better examples for this entirely unrelated topic.
Okay, Master of Puppets.
Master of Puppets. Okay, here we go. Okay, maybe I'm wrong. Listen. They play like three different Metallica songs on the local radio, and it's like, I swear to God, every time I hear them, I'm like, oh, I can just picture James just looking through inspirational quote books. It's just
inspirational quotes.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just really inspired by Metallica.
I think you love them secretly.
I do.
Just like you love Red Hot Chili Peppers these days.
Mm. There's the fucking lyrics. Look up some fucking Red Hot Chili, the newest Red Hot Chili Peppers song.
It's
ridiculous. Okay.
Oh, it's ridiculous. Is that ridiculous good or ridiculous bad?
It's great.
What's it called?
I don't know. Just say it, new song. Not Black Summer. It's not Black Summer. Oh. Tip of my tongue.
Tip of my tongue.
Yeah.
Tip of my tongue now.
No.
Oh, yeah, look, people say this all the time. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah.
No,
yeah,
this, yeah. No, look. This is a great song. It's ridiculous. Listen, well, I'm an animal, something like a cannibal. I'm very flammable and partially programmable. The centuries of overuse, now I wear it nice and loose. See?
Oh, man. Yeah. Eminem would be fucking
jealous. He's so jealous.
So jealous.
I can't even...
Ubiquitous. Tell me, can you stick with this?
I'm on the brink of this, and tell me what you think of this. I'm in the Beauregard. Slow me down if I get hard. Whoa. No, this is a great... great song. It's ridiculous. And this is this song and Black Summer made me like be like, okay, I can appreciate this band now, because this song's super silly and it's great. Like, the rhyming is great, and then Black Summer is just really good.
Well, fuck me on that note then. I mean, if ever there was something to make you not listen to us again, it's definitely Metallica sucks and Red Hot Chili Peppers are great. So I don't know why we're talking about this. We started with Kevin Costner, which had some kind of a link to what we'd spoken about. But Autumn is complaining of a hot right ear, and it really is. Like, her left ear is just white and feels quite cool to the touch, as you would expect. But her right ear is bright red and very, very hot.
It's so hot.
What's happening to Autumn?
Don't know.
I feel like I need to rub something gross on Autumn's lips just to round this
don't
out like a regular episode.
Come here.
I put it on you.
It's a booger. Fuck off.
I put it on your hot ear.
Why is my ear so hot? This used to happen to me when I was in school, like, taking tests and stuff. I don't know why, when I feel pressure or something, my right ear just, like, burns.
What pressure are you under, Autumn?
I don't know. Under pressure. Okay. Done. Goodbye.
Under pressure.
Goodbye.
I think all of you is hot. Did you just fart?
I wish.
That was for the microphone,
yeah,
not for you.
It's
you happen to be in
linger.
The way. Yeah, no, you were collateral damage there, man.
My machines don't do that. They're too small.
Wait, let me see if I can do it.
No, don't do
no,
it.
No, I won't I pinch hard. You just gotta get the technique right.
I don't like it.
Look, you gotta be close to the mouth hole.
I don't like it. Ow! Miskin too tight.
Unlike what?
Your mom's butthole.
Oh!